Welcome to the Florida Roundup this week on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. From protesters in Doral this week. To the United States Secretary of State in Miami this week as well.
I would counsel them that they need to be sensitive to the fact of discrimination, and they should not embrace a policy that is Cuban, which winds up discriminating against Americans.
Carnival Corporation coming under increasing pressure over beginning a cruise to Cuba. Secretary of State John Kerry there making his comments to Local 10 News reporter Michael Putney while he was in Miami. Now, Carnival's cruise brand Fathom got the okay by Cuban authorities last month to start cruising from Port Miami. The controversy came when it was learned that Cuban-born Americans are not allowed on that cruise. They can't legally arrive in Cuba on board any boat, so Carnival won't sell them tickets. Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez is one of those. He was born in Cuba, and he thinks Carnival is violating a county ordinance banning discrimination based on national origin.
People that were born in Cuba that are American citizens like I am cannot purchase a ticket from Carnival for a cruise, and that's discrimination.
Jimenez wouldn't say that he would block Carnival from using the county-run Port Miami for its Cuba cruise, but he's looking into whether he can take action based on Miami-Dade's human rights code. Lawyer Tucker Razzitti represents two people who filed a lawsuit this week against Carnival when they were denied tickets.
A company like Carnival, a company like Fathom, cannot look to another nation and say, because they're willing to discriminate, we'll be willing to discriminate.
Carnival issued a statement saying it's abiding by a Cuban policy that says no one born in Cuba can return there by sea. The company says it's working with Cuban officials in hopes of changing the policy. This is where we start the Florida Roundup. Carnival and Cuba. Do you support Carnival and it's abiding by Cuba policy? Do you want to sail there but can't because you were born in Cuba? Have you canceled your ticket because of the policy? Does it change your opinion about Carnival or cruising, other cruises that it offers? If you're a shareholder of Carnival, do you care about this? And get it started here on the Roundup, 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. All over social media, look for us on Twitter and Facebook. Look for WLRN. Chibeli Herrera covers tourism for our partner, the Miami Herald. Tim Padgett covers Latin American affairs for us here at WLRN. Fabiola Santiago is a columnist at our partner, the Miami Herald. And Fabiola, let's start there with you in the Doral newsroom. What happened when you tried to book passage?
Well, I first and foremost, I'm a journalist. And when I heard from someone else who was not able to book a trip, I then started someone with all the right credentials, right? We know Cuba discriminates. But the person who I interviewed has been going to Cuba since 1978. No problem there. Mm-hmm. She's been an academic who's been involved in exchanges. Really not the kind of person that Cuba turns down. So I was surprised that Carnival would turn her down. But I went through the process myself. I picked a sale date, and I called them as I would any other travel provider. I travel extensively around the world, so I had my passport, my credit card with me, and we started the booking. It was normal. I gave my name, my information, everything that was required, and when she was ready to take my credit card number, I then asked the consumer questions that you normally would ask about the, you know, what's the hurricane policy? Mm-hmm. And she assured me that I would get my money back. She went on to inform me that there was no insurance yet available for this cruise. And then I said, okay. And then we started talking. And then I said, you know, the paperwork, right? And up to this point, there had been no mention that Cuban Americans couldn't sail.
Sure.
She had accepted my name, Fabiola Santiago.
And accepted a passport.
Miami address.
Yeah.
Accepted an American. And then, you know, I asked the question. I said, you know, my passport says that I was born in Cuba when the passport issue came up. And she said, oh, just a minute, please hold. And she left. And when she came back, she said, the legal department says I have to read you this. And she read me the statement that I quoted in my column in the Miami Herald. And we, you know, I said, well, wait a minute. That, you know, you that you can't, you know, that that's Cuba's law, but I'm booking a cruise on an American ship mm-hmm. that sails out of the port of Miami. Mm-hmm. You can't deny me because I'm a Cuban American. I've been in this country for 47 years. I've been a citizen for 36, a voter. How can you deny me passage? And she was very nice person who said, I'm so sorry, ma'am. I'm so sorry. You know, we had a very good conversation. And but there was no way of getting her out of the, you know, she kept reading back to me the legal statement.
So they couldn't accept your reservation because you were Cuban born, even though you're an American citizen. Tim, what is the Cuban policy that's in question here that Carnival essentially is exercising?
Well, it's Cuban officials say it's part of their immigration policy. By forbidding Cuban-born people from leaving or entering the island by sea, Cuban officials say they hope the law discourages Cubans from making potentially deadly raft journeys to the U.S. Of course, real economic reform in Cuba might discourage that as well,
yeah,
but
sure.
that's another topic.
Yeah.
But the question, of course, is why this needs to apply to Cuban-born people who no longer live in Cuba, especially since Cuban Americans have been flying, you know, in and out of Cuba for decades now. I did have an informal chat about laws like or policies like these with an official from Cuba's foreign ministry when you and I were in Cuba last mm-hmm. month. And he seemed to be saying that to be effective, the rule has to apply to anyone born in Cuba. And this tends to be common, really, in Latin America. You know, my kids, for example, were born in Mexico. And if they were to return to Mexico someday, they could be subject to military service, though, there, even though they're U.S. citizens. But and this is a big but, because in this case we're talking about Cuba, you can't discount the likelihood that the rule is meant to spite Cuban exiles who for half a century have been considered enemies by the Cuban Revolution.
Ciavelli, this is not a policy that was put in place just prior to President Obama's historic visit or just after the president's visit, during which, of course, Carnival got the official okay from Cuban authorities to bring this ship into Havana Harbor. This is a policy that dates back to the Cold War era.
Yes, you're right, Tom. It is. It's a longstanding policy that Carnival knew about when they agreed to go with their cruises to the island. They say that Carnival says that they are requesting that Cuba change the policy, that by being able to travel to the island and have an open dialogue, it's an opportunity for them to continue pressing the Cuban government about changing the policy. And they maintain that this is an issue that. It's a policy that they have wherever they're traveling in the world about visa restrictions going into ports.
That they need to follow the restrictions and the policies and the laws of the country at which they are docking the ship at.
Correct.
Yeah. You know, back in October, when it had been just a few months after it was announced that Fathom, this brand of Carnival, was looking to sail into Cuba from the United States, we spoke with Carnival Corporation CEO Arnold Donald about this opportunity and about the discussions they were having at that time with Cuban authorities. Here's what he told us in October.
We are very confident by cooperating fully and giving a longer-term view because, of course, we're not interested in only sailing to Cuba with the one ship, that we will be granted the approvals required so we can begin our sailings in May of 2016 with Fathom.
Carnival Corporation CEO Arnold Donald speaking with WLR in October of 2015. Fast forward here, we're just weeks away from that first Carnival brand Fathom ship sailing from Port Miami to Havana and other stops in Cuba. And Cuban Americans are not allowed on board. Fabiola Santiago, the columnist of the Miami Herald that first covered this issue, Carnival is following the law of the country in which they are taking the ship to. So it's not Carnival's policy here. Rather, it's the Cuban policy at question, correct?
Right. Right. But Cuba is not holding a gun over Carnival's head. Cuba is saying, if you import our repressive and discriminatory laws, we'll let you dock in our ports. And so it becomes an ethical business decision for certain, maybe. I mean, I leave that up to the lawyers to hash it out in court. Perhaps it's even illegal by our laws.
And this is the question that the Mayor Jimenez was getting at, Tim, was whether or not it violates a human rights ordinance for Miami-Dade County.
Well, and that's one of the reasons the class action lawsuit was filed. That's based on a claim that Carnival, by following this Cuban policy, is violating federal anti-discrimination laws.
Chibeli, there has been previous cruise companies that have been cruising to countries that banned certain nationalities from coming in, and those cruise companies have followed the policy until they didn't follow the policy.
That's right. In 2014, Norwegian Cruise Line encountered a similar situation in Tunisia, where the Tunisian port officials were not allowing about a dozen Israeli travelers to disembark. And since then, Norwegian Cruise Line has stopped its sailings to Tunisia altogether.
Carnival's not alone in its desire to travel to Cuba. There's other cruise companies that are based here in Miami that are hopeful to follow Carnival's example, at least in terms of trying to get cruise ships into Havana and other ports.
Right. That's right. That's the important detail there. Norwegian has that example with Tunisia, but they have also applied to go to Cuba as well as Royal Caribbean.
But neither of those have gotten the Cuban permission, so we don't know if they would still cruise with this Cuban policy.
Right, and they'll say they can't. They can't comment on a hypothetical situation.
Listen, we want to hear your comments. Join the roundup here, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN on social media, Twitter, and Facebook as well. I'm going to go to the phones in one moment here. But, Tim, one question about this policy. It doesn't specify the size of the vessel, does it? Or is it just simply by water? Simply by water.
By water.
It could be an inner tube, or it could be a cruise ship.
For example, I mean, there are a lot of Cubans living on the island, for example, who complain that they're often told they can't even take a ferry journey to a little island off of the main island because of this policy.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the lines here. Virginia is joining us. First of all, you're first up, Virginia from Miami. Go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. Well, I agree with Carnival. You know, I know my fellow Floridians, Miamians might not, but they have to abide by that policy. If they have that policy, my question is this: they want everything changed because they're American, Cuban Americans, that we were born here. We can't go back to here. My question is this: this is a country. These are people that are trying to flee. Okay,
Cubans.
They're leaving the Cuban
on the island, right?
On the island, you know. Cuban Americans that we're here, because I'm a Cuban American.
Okay.
Okay. And our parents came from over there because we're being oppressed. So you want to go back the same way that you left. And you understand, it's like a double standard to me.
Seems like a double standard to you, Virginia. We appreciate the phone call there. Let's go to Curtis in Kendall. Curtis, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Go ahead. Your thoughts on this.
Hi. Happy Friday. First, story about my initial reaction to this and also a comment. When I first saw the story, I thought it was a case of Miami's Cuban-American population being maybe hypersensitive, like sometimes they are. And then I said, in order for this to be discrimination, you've got to have a protected class, and where somebody's born isn't a and I stopped myself and realized where you are born is a protected class. So in the end, I ended up siding with the mayor. And also the comment is this might be a teachable moment for capitalism to show how the free market can affect social and political change, similar to how divestment and boycott of South Africa about apartheid. So this could be a similar situation.
Curtis, you just used, I think, the magic words in this whole thing, teachable moment. In the context of normalization of relations with Cuba, this is a major teachable moment because I think it shows U.S. businesses who are thinking of moving ahead and doing business with Cuba, that they've got to be more aware of these kinds of minds that are out there, in front of them.
Curtis, we appreciate the thoughts here. To that point, Chibeli, what have we been able to tell when Carnival knew about this policy, if it was a policy that they were essentially ignorant of up until the moment that they got the okay by the Cuban authorities, or as the CEO of Carnival Corp told us in October, very confident by fully cooperating that they'll get the ship in.
Yes, I spoke to Arnold Donald earlier this week. He said that it was an issue, a policy that they were aware of, and then when they became aware that it was going to directly affect their cruise line, they sort of prepared for what they've expected is this kind of backlash.
Fabiola, is it super sensitivity on the part of South Florida as the relationship with Cuba is evolving quickly, and here we are again dealing with a Cold War era policy on the part of the island?
No, that's Cuban Americans are the only group that I know of often accused of sensitivity. I think that the definition of when something discriminatory against a group is when you replace it with another group. And if it's not acceptable, if something is not acceptable for one group, it isn't acceptable for others. And, you know, in reference to the first caller, for example, mm-hmm. I'm in this issue, I'm concerned about my rights as an American, okay? I'm approaching this situation first as an American. I don't want to be denied, I think, I don't want Cuba's repressive laws imposed on Americans in the United States. Now, you know, after my rights are restored to be on this cruise ship, I reserve the right to you know, not book it or book it. It's sure. a personal decision.
Sure, that's up to the market. Let me ask you, though, Fabiola. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, we've come through a series of changes when it comes to the travel restrictions that America mm-hmm. has placed on Americans. For a long time, one could argue there was travel discriminations that the American government placed on its own citizens in terms of traveling to Cuba, and those have slowly fallen away over the past 7 years.
Right. Right. And every American that I know who has wanted to go to Cuba has been able to go to Cuba. Mm. The only restrictions are, again, on the side of the Cuban government.
Right. And just to be clear, up until this point, mm-hmm. up until this Fathom Carnival branch shoves off from Port Miami mm-hmm. in early May, that had been traveling via airplane.
Exactly. And I should also add, And I want to make this very clear, that as an American, I am in favor of free travel. I think as Americans, we have the right to choose where we want to go and where we don't want to go. And I don't think anyone has should be stopping us. So I'm not coming at this as you know, people love to throw around the word intransigent and sensitivity
yeah.
and all these things that demean our point of view. But I'm coming at it as what I am, an American citizen of Cuban origin.
And that is Fabiola Santiago, also happens to be a columnist with our partner, the Miami Herald. Fabiola, thanks so much for sharing your story with us here on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you, guys. A pleasure.
Chibeli Herrera covering the hospitality and tourism industry for our partner, the Miami Herald, as well. Nice to see you back in the Roundup, Chibeli.
Happy to be here, Tom.
And Tim Padgett covering all things Latin America for us here at WLRN. Thanks so much, Tim.
Thank you.
We've got plenty more to come. The trouble at the top at Broward Health, the big public medical health system. But first, this month, we're inviting our listeners to write an ode to their zip code again this year. It's our community project with O Miami. We had this sent to us from Hialeah recently.
Ugly shop signs. Messy, bold, true. Cubans, always overdue. 33012.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. One of the biggest public hospital districts continues to be mired in controversy. This week, its chairman stepped down from the position of Broward Health, quitting over what he called political interference by Governor Rick Scott. On Monday, he was reinstated to the chairmanship position, though, by a Broward circuit judge. Governor Scott had suspended him back in March, citing malfeasance. But the judge this week ruled the governor did not have the authority to suspend him from the board without offering specific evidence. So after all of this and after challenging his suspension, David DiPietro told Channel 10 News this.
Every single public official in the state of Florida should be aware that what the governor did to me through an executive order with no facts, that they could be removed next.
The boardroom drama follows the suicide of Broward Health CEO Dr. Nabil El-Sanadi back in January and multiple inquiries into the hospital district's business practices, including an almost $70 million settlement over overbilling. So have you been a patient at Broward Health at a facility? Has the care been compromised by all these investigations and political intrigue into its business operations? Taxpayers who help support the hospitals, do you have confidence in the leadership to spend your money wisely? Let us know here as Broward Health is up next here on 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Rosemary O'Hara, Sun Sentinel editorial page editor, is along with us. Julie Kay, Daily Business Review reporter. And Dan Christensen with the Florida Bulldog editor, a nonprofit investigative website, is along with us as well. Dan, let's begin here. First of all, why the suspension of the chairman of Broward Health in the first place?
That's a good question, frankly. The governor didn't explain it in his order. He just relied on what was being told to him by his chief inspector general, and her reasons were vague.
And those reasons, though, were malfeasance.
Yes.
And the judge in,
that's pretty vague, though.
And the judge on Monday in the judge's ruling, which put aside the governor's suspension, allowed Mr. DiPietro to come back, said there wasn't enough evidence in here. And then fast forward to Thursday and the chairman resigns.
Right. Well, in between, the governor had appealed that ruling,
right,
which looked like it was going to delay this for a while. Now, Mr. DiPietro had indicated to me that he was going to be sticking around. So his resignation came as a surprise, and I don't know why that's the case. He hasn't explained himself what caused him to do that.
He did talk about political interference by Governor Rick Scott. Rosemary O'Hara with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, how political of a position is this chairmanship at Broward Health?
Well, all of these positions are appointed by the governor, the seven members of the board. You know, it's a shame. I got to say, it's a sad day to learn that David DiPietro decided to resign, because from where we sat, the chairman was the person who was asking the right questions, who refused to go behind closed doors when other members wanted to go behind closed doors. But in the end, you can't blame them for, you know, fighting a governor and an attorney general is a really tough thing to do, because they've got the taxpayer's checkbook that will pay for endless appeals. And, you know, this is a volunteer job. He doesn't get paid for it. It's caused a lot of stress. But the message, he's right, that what happened here was that the governor didn't like that Mr. DiPietro encouraged the board to hire a law firm to represent it in the inspector general's review of the board.
So let me unpack a little
like
bit of this, Rosemary.
He didn't like that they got a counsel to help him figure what all's going here. And so he suspended him.
Yeah.
And he suspended the audit committee chair. And, you know, for those of us who are watching this closely, it just looks like there's something going on here. And what could be going on here is that the governor is trying to destabilize this hospital district. Instead of doing something to help, given his experience in hospitals, with Broward Health coming up on a financial cliff June 30th, that they don't have the money to meet their bond covenant, this governor is piling on. And frankly, he owes us a better explanation. The judge made clear that there was no evidence that the governor offered that Mr. DiPietro did something wrong. So if you're going to suspend a guy and really drag him through the mud, at least have the decency to tell us why.
Rosemary, we should mention you're joining us via Skype, so that's why it's a little bit scratchy. There's a lot to unpack there, Julie, because there are multiple investigations that have happened. There is a state investigation that is underway that is very wide-ranging, and that has led to the board at Broward Health to at least go forth initially to hire some of its own investigators, its own investigative law firm, of which that then ended. Rosemary referred to that. So let's unpack a little bit of this. There's a lot of governance here. Some of this is really arcane, and it gets into healthcare management and nonprofit healthcare management. But at the end of the day, there are hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer dollars here at stake. So let's begin here. First of all, some of the further intrigue with Mr. DiPietro's wife, who is a Broward County judge, which is also a political position of sorts because it's an elected position. So we have her husband, who was chairman, suspended by the governor, brought back by a different judge's ruling, and now he resigns, and then further intrigue into the former chairman's wife, who also sits on the bench in Broward County.
I've just jumped into this story, so I commend Dan on he's been following this for a while. But yes, I've been following the judge part of it and the law firm part of it, and there's so many tentacles to this story. But yes, this judge Nina DiPietro, she was actually appointed by the governor.
Governor Scott.
I mean, times have changed. I mean, they were friends. These are all Republicans. DiPietro was a huge Republican fundraiser and supporter. Times have really changed. But anyway, she's up for re-election. She has collected more in campaign contributions than any judicial candidate, I believe, in South Florida. I checked it a couple months ago. More than $250,000. And, you know, when you go through about a third of those contributions, I believe, come from clinics and doctors. So it raises the question, of course, was her husband, you know, steering some of these campaign contributors to her?
Those questions are out there. Do we have any answers to them?
Well, I will tell you, I did speak to David DiPietro. He was pretty open with me, and he said, you know, I love my wife. I would do anything for her. I'm 99% sure my name is not on any host committees of fundraisers. I am part of the community. I am friends with doctors and clinics. I'm not going to deny that. But he didn't say, you know, outright, yes, I asked people to donate to her. But I want to mention that the latest that came out earlier this week, is that someone has filed a Judicial Qualifications Commission complaint against her. And that could be serious if they investigate. So that's another thing she's facing. And she's now starting to apparently return some of these contributions.
So we have the wife of the former chairman of Broward Health, who sits on the bench in Broward County under some scrutiny, under some significant scrutiny. Her husband stepping down, accusing the governor who appointed him to the job about some vague political interference in the position. In the meantime, Dan Christensen with the Florida Bulldog, there have been investigations into various financial dealings with this hospital district for a good number of months. Let's begin with the state investigation. This is a state review of contracts, thousands of them.
Yeah, well, we're not quite. It's kind of a strange bird here. There's no specific reason has been given for why they're doing it, frankly. And it looks more like it's politically motivated. It was announced the day that Dr. Elsinati was buried, and there just seems to be no reason for it. They expanded it recently, maybe it's a way to monitor what the feds are doing, because there's a federal grand jury looking at procurement practices up there.
That's the other part of this that I wanted to get to, which stems back to almost $70 million settlement back in 2015.
No, that's unrelated to that. This is new alleged procurement fraud and contracts and things.
So we've got the state inspector general looking at contracts. We have a federal grand jury also looking at procurement practices.
Correct. And now DiPietro is gone. I think that drama is over. More important are some of the issues that I think are symptomatic here of what's gone wrong at Broward Health. The first one we reported on, or several, but we reported this week about millions of dollars in legal fees that were paid to two big law firms, Foley and Lardner and Greenberg Traurig, with strong political ties to the governor. More interesting than that to me is the district's 25-year no-bid contract with 21st Century Oncology, a Fort Myers company in which Governor Scott owned an indirect financial interest through a private equity firm in which he had a $200,000 stake in. Now, after 21st Century got that contract with the approval of the board that he helped appoint back in 2012, the company contributed about $400,000 to the governor's re-election campaign, and another almost $300,000 to the Republican Party of Florida.
Rosemary, help us unpack a lot of what Dan's investigations have found as we follow those money trails through to the point of your concern, which is this is a hospital district that relies to some degree on taxpayers in Broward County. And it is a hospital district that recently got a credit downgrade from Moody's, the credit rating agency, because of a, quote, sharp decline in operating performance during the fiscal year. It also cited some of these managerial and senior leadership troubles, but really some problems around its business operations.
Well, it's a political entity. It spends $1.2 billion a year. I mean, a lot of that is on and staff, but a lot of it is on contracts for the provision of services. How you get these contracts are often political. You know, people hire lobbyists in order to get contracts at the hospital system. And in the legislature this year, there was an effort to require the registration of lobbyists, and the hospital district's lobbyists were the biggest, you know, people fighting this thing. So, you know, this world is a political world. You get on this board because you're a You have fundraisers and you're a political player and you give to the governor. You know, now we learn that you get contracts because of who your lobbyists are. And the problem is that that we don't have good oversight of, you know, what's going on here. And so we see these no bid contracts happening, and it just doesn't give you confidence that, you know, that somebody's minding the store and that the governor is interfering right now.
Dan, who is minding the store? Who is the legal controlling authority? Who are the group or a regulatory agency that should be oversight?
Well,
here?
The Board of Commissioners. I would call it a troubled Board of Commissioners.
The Broward County Board of Commissioners.
No, the Board of Commissioners of Broward Health itself. Remember, the Broward Health's formal name is the North Broward Hospital District. It's an independent taxing district, and it's run by these, frankly, mostly obscure people. David DiPietro, a few weeks ago or months ago, nobody knew who he was, even though he was the chairman of this place. It operates a lot, even though they have meetings, public meetings, there's a lot of stuff that's done in secret. And there was another big contract involving an advertising agency.
Right.
They wanted to spend approximately $70 million. That was all negotiated and pushed in secret. And the Dr. Elsinati's death sort of derailed the thing.
Yeah. And speaking about the board and board responsibility here, Julie Kay, we know that back in February, the board was going forth with its own investigation and had hired an outside law firm and charged it with going forth and looking into some of these rumors and speculations about the financial dealings. What became of that?
Absolutely fascinating. They hired, if there's a Democratic law firm in town that's known to support Democrats, and perhaps that was purposeful to see that they would be completely independent, but that's who was hired, Berger Singerman. They were hired for $200,000. Everyone says very reputable, very well-respected lawyer, Mitchell Berger. He spent 5 weeks doing an investigation, and the minute he started clearing and finding no wrongdoing and defending the general counsel there, and then he sent a letter to the governor protesting the suspension of DiPietro. Suddenly he was terminated by the board after 5 weeks.
This democratically leaning law firm was dismissed by a generally Republican board of commissioners for Broward Health.
Once those two commissioners, David DiPietro and the other gentleman, were suspended, those were the David was the one that brought them aboard. Once they were gone, suddenly they were fired. So
Dan Christensen, where are we left here? We're left with the state investigation ongoing into contracts. We're left with the federal grand jury investigation into procurement practices. And we're left with Broward Health financial situation, which is troubled, according to Moody's Investor Service, the credit rating agency, in part because of a payout of a recent legal settlement that totals about $70 million to the feds.
Right. I think their situation operationally has problems, but they do have a lot of cash. I was told when they announced that settlement back in September by David DiPietro that the district had an additional, I believe it was $700 million in reserves. So they're going to be able to pay their bond covenants here. They've got the assets to do that. The concern here is, I think, and it was expressed by some of the staff, including key physicians at the hospital, Dr. Yogel, who's the chief of staff at Broward Health Medical Center, the old Broward General in Fort Lauderdale. He came in and I heard him say, I couldn't believe it, frankly. He said that patient care there was hanging by a thread. Not that he was saying that the individual doctors weren't doing their jobs. He was saying they weren't getting the backup they needed. They weren't getting contracts processed to bring in the supplies that they needed, that sort of stuff.
Rosemary, have we seen all of these, all of this drama and this intrigue begin to creep into the care of the hospital district and the care and the public health of Broward County citizens?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I've talked to one doctor there who is a cardiologist who says that a machine that she needs to do ablations, she cannot use because the contract has not made its way through the legal department. The medical staff there is extremely frustrated. You know, you got to believe and you know that the medical staff is good. The nurses care. They're about giving quality care. But the holdup in the administration, in the legal department, to getting the tools they need to provide the care, there's been a real bottleneck. So they're crying for help. They're crying for leadership. And again, you know, in some ways, Mr. DiPietro was trying to address that. And in his effort to try to move things through, the governor pulled the rug out. And so now the question is, you know, the big other question looming over this is he destabilizing the district because he doesn't like public hospital districts and ultimately wants to sell? There's rumors of a you know, hostile takeover in the South Broward district. Something is afoot here, so there is a lot more to come.
A lot more to come. The controversy and investigations into Broward Health here on the Florida Roundup. That was Rosemary O'Hara, the South Florida Sun Sentinel editorial page editor. Julie Kay along with us as well. Her perspective on the legal industry with the Daily Business Review. And Dan Christensen, the dogged Florida Bulldog editor. Great to speak with all three of you here on the Florida Roundup. Still to come is a man-made mosquito right to fight bugs in the Keys. But first, more zip odes, inviting listeners to write an ode to their zip code, our community project with O Miami. This from the Wynwood Edgewater area.
Hipsters are here. Artists are here. And I am here, wondering where the hell I fit in. 33137.
We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. So they're out there. You've noticed them already, right? The pesky bugs buzzing around our backyards and front porches. We swat and spray. We dump out the water. We cut back the bushes. We get zappers and burn special candles. We spend millions of dollars through taxes and otherwise in the battle against the bug. It's a money fighting mosquitoes. This season, a specific species, the Aedes aegypti, brings a new threat to South Florida, the Zika virus. This species already brings with it the threat of other diseases, and the Florida Keys could be a laboratory for the latest science on how to stop the bug, possibly. British company Oxitec wants to test its genetically modified mosquito in Key Haven. Oxitec wants to conduct a field trial of these modified mosquitoes, but opponents in the Keys have been vocal. They've been giving elected folks an earful this week in Key West.
I don't want my grandkids, anybody, myself, to be infected by something you can't guarantee.
I mean, what are we, the guinea pigs for the whole United States? We shouldn't be the guinea pigs for the United States. We don't want them.
We live in Key Haven. We do not want an English company doing business in Key Haven, period.
Now, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is involved here, saying there's no evidence of an environmental impact based on field trials overseas. The FDA continues taking public comment until next month about whether or not to approve the GMO mosquitoes for the trial in Key Haven. Are you okay with genetically modified mosquitoes? What about the risk of the mosquitoes that already exist who have been spreading the diseases by these pests? What's the best science tell us about a way forward here? 800-743-WLRN from the Keys up to the Jupiter Inlet. 800-743-9576 and on social media at WLRN. And, of course, on Facebook as well. Let's begin in Key West with Nancy Klinger, our southernmost bureau reporter. Nan, what's the status of the GMO mosquito experiments in Key Haven right now?
Well, we're waiting for the final ruling from the FDA. So we have, as you said, we have another month more public comment. And then it's really the ball is in the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District's court. And I think that's where it's really going to get pretty tense around here.
Dr. Derek Nimmo is the Oxitec project manager in the Keys. He joins us from Oxford, England, here on the Florida Roundup. Doctor, your mosquitoes are designed, the way I understand it, to die young. How much shorter of a lifespan is the Oxitec GMO mosquito compared to a regular Aedes aegypti?
Hi, Tom. Yes. So we have put in a self-limiting gene into this mosquito. And what happens is we release males into the environment. Those males mate with females. Those males live about 2 or 3 days. And then the females that mate with our males, they inherit the self-limiting gene and their offspring die. And if you do these releases 2 or 3 times a week over about 6 to 9 months, you can achieve greater than 90% control of the mosquito population.
Doctor, what do you mean by control of the mosquito population?
Yes, so that's a greater than 90% reduction in the number of mosquitoes that are out there compared to a control site where you haven't actually done the releases of the mosquito.
Yeah,
so it's a direct reduction in the numbers.
You and your company have gotten an earful from the folks in the Lower Keys, certainly. What's the size of the trial that you want to conduct in Key Haven?
Yes, yeah, so we're proposing to do about 16 hectares in Key Haven, or a third of the Key Haven residency there. It's about 100 houses, something like that.
And how do you disperse your mosquitoes?
Literally, we put the adult mosquitoes in pots, and they're driven to the Key Haven site, and then you open a pot, and about 1,000 mosquitoes, male mosquitoes, come out, and then they fly off. And within 20 to 30 seconds, you cannot see those mosquitoes. The males go and hide.
And how long?
Their only job is to find females so that those males do not bite or transmit disease.
And how long does your trial, how long are you proposing your trial to last in Key Haven if you're successful in being able to do it?
Yes, if it's successful, the trial should take somewhere between 6 and 9 months.
And the goal would be within those 6 or 9 months, if I hear you correct, would be a reduction in the Aedes aegypti population in that Key Haven neighborhood by 90%.
Yes.
We have with us Barry Ray. He is with the Florida Keys Environmental Coalition. Thanks for coming up to the studios, Barry. You're opposed to this kind of GMO experimentation. Why?
We're opposed to it at this time. There's a longer history, and let me correct a few things. It's the intent of OxyTech to release only males. That's not what happens. There's a certain percentage of females that are released. Females bite. First point of concern.
So let me just confirm that with Dr. Nimmo. Doctor, is that correct, that you can't guarantee solely males, solely GMO-altered males will be involved in this release?
That's correct. About 1 in 10,000 of the males are females. So we'll be releasing about, over that 6 to 9 months, about 300 females. But that is significantly less than the wild-type mosquitoes. And these mosquitoes, the protein that we put in, the self-limiting protein, is non-toxic, non-allergenic, and it's not in the saliva.
Gotcha. Okay, so Barry, go ahead.
Let me continue with that.
Sure, please do.
So the total number of mosquitoes being released, if you actually look at the EA that they applied for, this experimental application that they put in with the FDA, would add up to about 22,000 mosquitoes over 22 months. That's what's actually in writing. What Derek's saying is, oh, no, we modify that, and we won't need to do that many. That's a big difference, you know, but what's in writing is what I'm telling you.
Right. So what you're saying is the experiment would add 22,000 mosquitoes to the population. 22 million mosquitoes,
yes,
over the course of the nine-month experimentation.
Right. So when we talk about 1 in 10,000, now you've got a much more significant number of females getting released. Now, the second part that we need to correct is all the offspring don't die. There's a percentage, 3 to 5% is what they publish now, but we know in errant trials that happen in the lab, wasn't OxyTech's fault, I'll correct that right there, up to 18.3%, I think it was, actually survived in the lab. It was some number in that range.
So about 1 in 5.
Oh, yeah.
Of 18, roughly 20%. Dr. Nimmo, is that correct?
That was an errant trial, as Barry pointed out. So that was where there was slight tetracycline contamination. So the result without tetracycline is 3 to 5%.
Now, what most people don't understand is all your pet food is heavily laden with tetracycline. That was actually how the experiment went awry in France. It was because of cat food that they were feeding to the mosquitoes. So now you take, if you know the Keys very well, there's a lot of wild cats and a lot of people that feed those wild cats, so the dishes are just outside. There's all kinds of things that go on in terms of cat food pollution of water that exists, and it's standing water.
Dr. Nimmo, is there a way to protect against that in the Key Haven trial if you're successful?
Yes. So the tetracycline contamination in the environment, if these mosquitoes do breed in those bowls, which they normally don't because, you know, people re-put in food, etc. But, you know, what if they do? Well, if they do, they could make it to adults, or a higher proportion could make it to adults. Now, those adults still carry the self-limiting gene, so they still sort of pass it on to the next generation, or 50% of the next generation. And also, that's very transient. So tetracycline is broken down very quickly in sunlight. It's had a half-life of about 30 minutes in sunlight. So whereas in the lab, we can get this these sort of results, we don't have sunlight. Sunlight breaks down tetracycline very quickly. So we wouldn't expect it to be there in enough concentrations. Even if it is, it wouldn't affect a control program.
Barry, let me ask you, are there practices or procedures that OxyTech could take regarding its Key Haven experimental application that you and the coalition could support?
Well, right now, that's part of the problem. Let's go back a little bit in history and look at what's happened here, why we're at this state today. Originally, when this was presented, a lot of people said, well, that's pretty intriguing, naturally. Well, as the answers started to come, people didn't like the answers. So what ended up happening was the city of Key West said, look, we're not comfortable with where we are. We're going to give you three criteria. We want to know who your regulating authority is. We want to know what your standards for success or failure are. And we want to know also what are your standards for releasing any of these animals. You know, this is a new species and we're concerned here. Those answers weren't really forthcoming. What ended up happening is after Key West passed that resolution of no confidence until you answer these questions, they moved the experiment to Key Haven.
Right.
Oh, more questions.
Let me go back down to Key West and bring in back our southernmost reporter, Nan Klinginer. Where does this stand with the Mosquito Control Board? Five members of that board spread across the Keys. This is clearly hyper-concentrated in one specific district. Nan, what kind of support does this experiment have right now, even as it has not yet gotten the FDA approval?
Yeah, it had pretty strong support from the board in terms of going forward, having OxyTech build a lab in Marathon. At this point, we had on our air Steve Smith, the vice chair, just a week ago or so, saying he would not support it because he felt like the public didn't support it. He didn't have a problem with the trial. He thought it was perfectly safe. But the public opposition had basically made him think this was not an appropriate place for this to take place. And he's up for election this year, and so are two of the other Mosquito Control Board members.
Nan Klinginer joining us from our southernmost bureau in Key West via Skype. We want to thank also two members of this debate, Dr. Derek Nimmo, OxyTech Keys Project Manager with us from Oxford, England, and Barry Rye along with us as well, the Florida Keys Environmental Coalition. Public comment still going on for this. Lots of public comment. Not the last time that we've visited this issue as well. Dr. Nimmo and Barry, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
All this month, we've been asking you for your ode to your zip code. It's part of the Poetry Festival, Oh Miami. We want your five-line poems about where you live using the digits of your zip code to determine how many words per line.
My name is Cherry Pickman. I live in Shorecrest, and this is my zip ode. I know manatees who frequent Wonderland when dawn blues. Do the sidewalks, power-washed, policed, look whiter to you? 33138.
My name is Pat Gavin. I live in Oakland Park, and this is my zip ode. Everyone is gay in my neighborhood. Houses are immaculate. Lawns are spectacular. I like it here. 33334.
Celebrating the rough edges from Palm Beach to the Keys. Submit your zip ode at WLRN.org/zip ode. We got a handy zip ode generator right there for you for our poetry in paradise.
Finally, in the roundup this week, we say goodbye to someone who's been instrumental in putting this program together each week. Julia Duba has been an associate producer here at WLRN, working on the roundup and newscasts in the afternoon. But she's done much more and meant much more to our newsroom. She's been a writer, reporter, and anchor. She started as a FIU student taking a class taught here at WLRN, learning radio, reporting, and journalism. One of her first interviews in that class, her dad, Bill, talking about his morning ritual making Brazilian espresso.
It's very tasteful. It reminds me of my childhood.
Julia's own childhood here in South Florida was shaped in part by Hurricane Wilma, something she wrote about for the 10th anniversary of this storm this past October.
As soon as I stepped out of bed, I felt dizzy. When I walked into the living room, I saw my parents, my brother, and my grandma looking up at our swaying chandelier. We'd filled the bathtub with extra water in case there wasn't any running water later, and now it was all swishing around like a wave pool. It wasn't that I was dizzy. The whole building was swaying.
Julia's essay, Remembering Wilma, recently won a statewide journalism contest, the latest of many awards in her young career and many more to come, I'm certain of. The media world is certainly changing fast and evolving in ways we can't even imagine today, but we know that whatever the future of journalism is, it's bright, Julia, with you in it. Best of luck and all that you make of it. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks to all the callers that participated in our program. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. WLRN's program director is Peter J. Meritz. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. The Florida Roundup this week was produced by Julia Duba. Thank you.